All right, Curtis. So who were some of the guys that you were listening to in Oregon when you were first starting out?
I was raised in the same house, never moved, in Eugene, Oregon.
Wow.
And people locally in town, there wasn't a lot when you're coming up as a kid. But my folks were jazz enthusiasts, so they had a lot of cool jazz music. And
sure.
What I was exposed to was, musically exposed, was Count Basie, Fats Waller, Earl Father Hines, Teddy Wilson, Bix Beiderbecke, Fletcher Henderson, Duke Ellington, a little bit of that. Mostly piano players, especially
okay.
like Fats Waller and Teddy Wilson, Count Basie, and the Boogie Woogie players, and of course Gene Krupa, Anita O'Day. And that's what launched me. Of course, one of the biggest things that moved me as a kid was this record. And it was recorded in 1938, but they didn't release it until like the late 50s. And it was Benny Goodman live at Carnegie Hall, 1938. And this was the concert that swing and jazz first played Carnegie Hall. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I don't think I have. I don't think I've heard that one.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of changed the... It's one of the pivotal changes in American music was that concert. And it was integrated. It had Count Basie, Black Orchestra, mixing with Benny Goodman's predominantly white orchestra.
Right.
But there was also Charlie Christian, who was black, and probably one of the greatest jazz guitar players that ever lived, still to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And Benny Goodman and Lionel Hampton and Harry James, the trumpet player, Gene Krupa, the drummer, Jess Stacy. You know, if you look it up on the internet, which is like the Oracle, you could see the history of that concert. Benny Goodman, 1938, live at Carnegie Hall. It was really a pivotal moment for me as well when my dad turned me on to it and told me some of the like hidden little treasures that are in that recording.
Wow.
So I grew up really into this stuff.
Yeah, it sounds
and
like
then
that.
I have an older brother. I have an older brother and older sister. And, of course, they came up during the folk era. So, and, you know, at the same time, record companies realized that old blues that they had recorded, like Robert Johnson and Son Howe, Mississippi Fred McDowell and Mississippi John Hurt and all these guys, they started repackaging those records that they recorded in the 30s and putting them out in the early 60s as folk blues during the folk era.
Mm-hmm.
And so was Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee and of course, Big Bill Brunsey. And so my older brother and sister were bringing that home, and I was exposed to that. So jazz and blues, and a little bit of gospel.
Yeah, a little bit of everything, huh?
Yeah. Well,
so, yeah, go ahead.
What's hip? I mean, you know, that's pretty hip stuff, I think.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
So when did you pick up the harmonica then?
You know, here's another thing with my folks. I took guitar lessons, and I took guitar lessons, and I had a really mean guitar teacher.
Really?
If I didn't get the lesson right, he'd go, no, it's like this, and he'd kick me in the shin. And he'd do this, like this, and it was like, God. And I was 13 years old, 14, and so, you know, the guitar lessons. You know, this is going on for a couple of months. And my mother kind of guitar fell away from me. And my mother brought me home a book, How to Play Blues Harmonica by Tony Little's Son Glover. And Tony Little's Son Glover had the only harmonica how to play blues book for years. I mean, into like, you know, until probably the late 80s. It's the only book really about how to play blues harmonica. And it was wrong, but my mother brought me that back and brought me a harmonica. After that, I didn't listen to Paul Butterfield anymore. I discovered Little Walter. And then, of course, I put two and two together and discovered that Little Walter is the harmonica player in all the Muddy Waters records
right.
that I received my brother. You know, Christmas come along, I'd get four or five albums. I remember one Christmas, it was Sail On, a Chess Records Sail On album of Muddy Waters.
Yeah, yeah, I know that
Walter.
One.
Yeah, Hate to See You Go. And then the Columbia recording of Johnny Winter. Remember when he did Drowned in My Own Tears? On that
yeah,
record?
Yeah, that's a good one.
That is a good Johnny Winter record, man. And Walter Horton and Willie Dixon are on it, you know. So, you know, my older brother and older sister were into contemporary, and that's what the college kids were listening to, mm-hmm. were these old blues masters, along with, you know, the British rock and roll stuff and whatever pop music. FM radio kicked in about this time, and, of course, that changed the airwaves because, you know, people were playing entire records on there.
Right.
And and music was the only thing that really tickled my auditory nerve and got me, you know, interested in doing something.
Right.
You know, like do something, find your niche. And that's what my folks noticed. And so they promoted it, you know. So instead of going to the University of Oregon, my folks had money set aside from my grandfather. And really, it wasn't enough money to buy books for an entire first semester of books at the University of Oregon. And they said, you know what? We're not going to pressure you into going into college. Why don't you just do what your heart wants and spend the money we have here on stuff that has to do with music.
Wow. That had to be great to hear.
Yeah, yeah, so it was. And so I bought an amplifier, you know, a better, you know, and voice lessons.
Wow.
And, yeah, took voice lessons. I was singing since kindergarten in choirs. I was even in, you know, glee club stuff in high school. So I was noticed as a singer in kindergarten when my mother put a pin on the teacher put a note, pinned it to my chest, and my mother read it. So during all the stuff I just told you, meanwhile, I'm singing in choirs in grade school and junior high and music, and then I toured with a glee club, you know, and we did blues as part of the special, you know, we ended with a blues boogie woogie.
Nice.
You don't have to write that shit down, but you know. Point is, music has been my push since kindergarten.
Right.
You know, since the teachers pinned a note on my chest.
So, tell me, how'd you end up playing with Robert Cray?
Robert moved from Tacoma, Washington, to Eugene, Oregon, and I had a band there called the Nighthawks, and Robert Cray and Tom Murphy and Richard Cousins started coming down to Eugene, and eventually Robert found a girlfriend there, and so did Richard Cousins, and Richard and I headed off. Robert's pretty shy, but, you know, they used to come over to my house, and I remember them throwing rocks at my window and see what my collection was, you know, and then we'd hang out and listen to records, and we were, all three of us were on the same page.
Yeah.
And they used to have a drummer named Tom Murphy, who was very good. And those guys were from Tacoma. And they moved down to Eugene. But Richard Cousins and I ended up hanging out a lot together, and Robert. And Richard and I ended up getting an apartment together for about 4 years, over a period of 4 years. Yeah.
Wow.
From about 75 to 79, you know. And we lived together, and Robert and Richard had both found a girlfriend that they were living with and hanging out with. And they moved to Eugene, is my point.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I ended up with Robert. And Robert would, he had a, you know, killer band with him. He had Cousins and Tom Murphy and Robert and Hammond B3 player they eventually hired out of Portland, Oregon, named Dover Weinberg, who is playing with Robert now.
Oh, really?
Robert rehired him a few years ago. Anyhow, long story longer, Robert had a great band. And the guitar player in my band, I said, there's these guys in town, man, you got to check them out. They're young and black. And I mean, you know, to me it was like, nobody young and black is listening to Elmore James and Muddy Waters. Yeah. And so my guitar player went and saw him. I was 19. I wasn't allowed in a bar. And, you know, I couldn't just, I could play in a bar, but you can't just, you know, go up to the door and get in. Anyone. So he reported back to me and said, these guys are killer, and you got to see them. So anyhow, we all kind of hooked up. And we'd already hooked up, but I didn't get to see him. And then my guitar player called and said, these guys are monsters. And then eventually, of course, we started jamming together in various friends' houses and stuff. And that's when I first heard Robert and Richard. And Richard, man, you know, just as much as Robert, Richard is something to behold. He's one of the best bass players, I think, in the business.
Wow.
And so we just got together and we started doing gigs together in Eugene, the Nighthawks, not to be confused with Washington, D.C. Nighthawks. So let's stop right there. The D.C. Nighthawks were in Washington, D.C., East Coast, big, you know, lots of population of people.
Sure.
Kind of different than Eugene, Oregon. There's probably at this point less than 2 million people in the entire state. So the Nighthawks had their business together more than we did. We had an EP out with four songs on it, extended play, a little 45. Yeah. They came out with a record, and that pretty much ended the Nighthawks, and I ended up joining Robert Craig. The Nighthawks were very popular, though, and we would play gigs with them, and, you know, dual gigs.
Sure.
And then we hung out with each. And then on off nights, in other words, not the weekend, on weeknights, mm-hmm. Robert Cray and Richard would get together with the drummer of the Nighthawks, his name was David Olson, and with me, and maybe the keyboard player for Robert, or the keyboard player for my band, his name is D.K. Stewart, and we'd play at various places around Oregon on off nights, you know, because we got to pay rent to play music.
Yeah.
So, we called our little splinter band, we called it the Crayhawks.
Crayhawks, I like that.
Yeah, yeah. And that's when Bellucci, you know, first he saw the Nighthawks and came up to me, not him. But
well, you're actually leading into my next question, though.
Good.
cool. So you said that's when you met John Bellucci when you were playing with the Nighthawks. So what did you guys talk about? How did that meeting happen?
Well, have you read anything about it, first of all?
Yeah.
That's okay. Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm going to give you the exact same story I've been telling since the moment it happened.
That's fine with me.
I didn't know who John Bellucci was. A cocaine dealer came up to me and yanked on my pant leg in the middle of a song. We were playing at a venue called the Eugene Hotel, which was a hotel. We're playing in the ballroom of the Eugene Hotels. And it's a dual show. Robert Cray Band and the Nighthawks. And we played on a Friday and Saturday night. We would alternate the headline.
Mm-hmm.
Robert opened up, and then the Nighthawks played, or the Nighthawks would open up, and Robert would play, and then we'd all get together at the end. So that's the show to your listeners, or if you're writing this. That's what's going to happen. And in the middle of my show with the Nighthawks, a cocaine dealer comes up, and we all know who he is because he's the dealer in town, one of them. He goes, hey, and you got to understand, you know, people might roll their eyes, but everybody and their dog was doing cocaine.
Right.
You know, so he comes up and yanks on my leg and goes, Bellucci wants to meet you. And I am singing in the middle of a song. So I go, what? And I'm singing. And then what?
Right.
In between phrases of singing, I'm going, Bellucci wants to meet you. And I said, I told him to scram, get out. Go away. His name was Richard, but we called him Little Dick because he was only about 5'2". So, you know, Richard, go away. And then, you know, three songs later, he comes up, Bellucci wants to meet you. What the hell are you talking about? You know, go away. And then at the end of the set, immediately I jump off the stage and I'm walking towards a group of friends, or girls, basically, mm-hmm. and you know, I know him, and I'm going over there. I can still picture him. And this Richard, or Little Dick, grabs my arm, spins me around, and goes, "This is John Belushi. He wants to meet you." So he comes up to me, and we shake hands. And Sam, if you can imagine, you and I shake his hands, and I kind of look over my shoulder, like, you know, like, "Hi, what?" You know, I didn't. I just like, "Hi, nice to meet you." What, you know, kind of turned away, right. And said, "That's how it was." And he's like, "Whoa, yeah, what's up? What do you want?" And he realizes, I'm pretty sure he realized immediately that I didn't know who he was or cared. And I said, and he goes, "Oh, yeah, I like your music. Thank you." He says, "You remind me of a friend. You kind of look like him, too. His name is Dan Aykroyd." I said, "Okay, great." And he goes, "He plays harmonica, too." And I remember, this is the truth. I have no proof except for my brain. As I thought to myself, who gives a shit? And, you know, another harmonica player is right. Something the world needs, you know. And I know this well, especially if they can't play. So, you know, I'm like, okay, great. You know, and he goes, "Yeah, I'm with this movie in town." So I said, "Oh, really? Robert's in that movie? Did you see?" He goes, "Yeah, I saw Robert today." I said, "Oh, really? Now, put a pin in that." Go back to me and Richard about 2 weeks sitting in our apartment when Richard says to me, "Hey, I guess Robert got a part in a movie." And that was about the end of that. I was like, "Oh, really? Huh?" And so now here this guy is going, "Yeah, I'm in a movie that's in town." My first thought was, "Oh, yeah. And Robert, did you see Robert? Robert got up." He goes, "I saw Robert today. Yeah, he taught us how to dance." And we started talking about the movie and who else was in it.
Mm-hmm.
Because in that scene in Animal House is a bunch of musicians
right.
that are from the Northwest. A couple of them were from Portland, and the rest of them were from Eugene and at the University of Oregon. And so I don't want to waste your time with who they are, but, you know, some of them are still around, man.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that said, you know, he's telling me about this, and we start talking, and then Belushi changes the subject and goes, "Yeah, you know, it's really hard. I'm doing this movie, and then I have to get together, and we have to, I have to fly back to New York to do this show called Saturday Night Live, and it's kind of a variety show." And I go, "I'm just looking at him," and he realizes by now I don't know any of this stuff.
he probably wasn't used to that at the time.
Yeah, and he's not. I mean, people know they're in town, and I am totally unaware of, you know, we always pack the house. I didn't know that Doug Kenny's there, you know. That some of the actors that are in are hanging out in Eugene or at this gig, and so I don't know that. And so so he goes, "Yeah, I have to fly here, and then I got to fly back to New York to do, you know, have to do a stage call and dress rehearsal for a show, and then I have to fly." I'm going, "Oh, that's great, great." And then all of a sudden he says, "But I'm really excited about this weekend because we're going to have Ray Charles." I said, "What? Ray Charles? You're going to have Ray Charles?" And that's when... Now he's got my attention, and I just start gleaming to him like like cold on ice, man. Thinking, "Ray Charles, you got to talk to him. Ask Ray Charles about Guitar Slim." He goes, "Who's Guitar Slim?" I said, "You don't know who Guitar Slim is? Oh, my God, Ray Charles plays piano. It's on one of the greatest hits of all time, one of the biggest blues R&B hits called The Things I Used to Do, 1953 specialty records, da-da-da-da-da. Did you know Ray Charles plays alto saxophone?" He goes, "He plays alto." "Yes, it's on a song called Hot Rod. It is, Live at Newport, 1958, Atlantic Records." So check this out. So we go up, smoke a joint, come down, finish the show. A couple of days later, he calls me up, and I come over and have dinner with him and Judy Jacklin, who's his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And and he goes, "Come on over, have dinner with us, like to whatever, and I want you to bring those records you were talking about." So I brought him a pile of my records. Little Walter, Sonny Boy Williamson 1, Sonny Boy Williamson 2, Lowell Fulson, Ray Charles, Muddy Waters, Little Walter, on and on and on, Howlin' Wolf. I brought him a ton of stuff, soul stuff, you know. And he really got into it. And then, about a week or so later, when the Ray Charles thing aired, everybody was calling me up, musicians. It was like the talk of Eugene musician circles. I guess Ray Charles was on Saturday Night Live, and he played alto saxophone for the first time in like 17 years.
Wow.
And I'm like, I think I have something to do with that. Now, I can't really take ownership of that, but I'm taking ownership of it because I meet this guy who I don't know who's with this show called Saturday Night, and I told him about Ray Charles and the alto saxophone. I mean, I realize now that maybe Paul Schaefer told him, or one of the band members, of course. You know, I mean, Blue Lou was in the Saturday Night Band and all this shit. But me, I told him this, and the next thing I know, Ray Charles is on this popular show. By the way, I won't even see that show.
Right.
And for a couple of more months. I mean, it took me about half a year to even see Saturday Night Live. You know, and you know how I saw it? At a nightclub, and everybody... Bellucci called me up and said, Curtis, we're going to mention your name on our show. I go, really? He goes, yeah, could you tell me that little bit of business that you did? You know, I'm going to make like a mile, make like a camel and walk a mile. So, you know, so anyhow, to make this short and edit it for you, you know, he called me up and I was at a rehearsal. And I don't know how he found me at this house, but it was where we were rehearsing. So he called somebody up who knew somebody in our circle, and he said, I'm going to mention your name on Saturday Night Live, and you can see it on YouTube. It's like the first time the Blues Brothers ever play on Saturday Night
right.
Live. And anyhow, and he was also doing songs as the Killer Bees. That was the first, they were like these bees.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first time they were doing, I never saw that. But that's when Bellucci was getting turned on to the blues in Eugene, Oregon, by yours truly. And then they did the Blues Brothers act, and they mentioned my name. And he calls me up, and I gave him a bit, are you going to make like a camel and walk a mile or make like Chesterfield and satisfied? Well, it depends on what you're packing. She says regular king size. And so I pulled out my Jim Beam and stuck it in her crab tree and gave her a shot of cream of Kentucky, and that created the Wilkinson fan. And so this was all stuff, and Bellucci's going, I can't use most of that. That's pretty, you know, that's pretty. I said, you know, so I was giving him bits of business over the phone.
Yeah.
So I just told you a whole, you know, we ended up, long story short, there's a lot of great stuff I could tell you here, but long story short, we ended up being friends. And friends enough to where we could argue about stuff. He invited me to L.A., to Hollywood, to watch him film the movie 1941. And our relationship continued until the day he passed.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So in that first meeting,
and
or maybe...
I wish he was alive today.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and I wish he was alive today. It would be nice.
A lot of people wish that, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you see his act on SNL, and when he's talking to you on the phone, I mean, do you have any idea, you know, you're kind of helping, you know, inspire the creation of, you know, the Blues Brothers movie eventually?
By the time, now, there's no movie going on, but if you want to go into this direction, I will continue, because it does go on. So he calls me up, and he says to me, now remember, we're at rehearsal, and we're going to go play a club in Corvallis, that is north of Eugene, Oregon, and it's the University, Oregon State University is where that is. Oregon University is in Oregon Campus University is in Eugene. Oregon State University is in Corvallis, 40
gotcha.
Miles. Yeah. Okay, so there's a club there, and it's called Mother's Mattress Factory, and we're playing there. And I know that I'm going to be going to stick my name on Saturday Night Live. And so we had an extra long setup so that it's timed right in coordination with the show. And the band takes a break, and everybody in this club, and there's about 250 people, you know, probably, well, yeah, disco about 200 people, you know, we all shut down. We all go over to another part of the club, which has this sunken living room. And it was during those times when it was those big screen television, but back then it was a giant box of three different lights. That three different. Remember those?
Yeah,
old
yeah.
Are you old enough for that? This is way before digital. This is how, you know, it was like big screen television, but it was like it was huge. and you could, you know, flash it up on a screen. So they put Saturday Night Live, and this would be the first time I saw it. And then it starts out with Paul Schaefer doing an imitation of Don Kirshner's rock concert. And he goes, the blues is this, and now here are Curtis Salgado, here are thanks to Curtis Salgado and the Cray Band. And he turns and goes, the Blues Brothers. And that was, you know, that she gave credit where credit is due. And you have seen the Paul Schaefer imitation.
Yeah, I did.
Here are, okay, good. I'm glad it's out there. But sometimes I can't find it. Anyhow.
Pretty sure it's on their best of DVD, I think.
Oh, cool. I have no idea. I know it's on YouTube, but about a year ago I was looking for it and never found it. Anyhow, so here is, and they do it, and that's when I knew. I just went like, holy shit. People were coming up to me going like, yeah, he stole your act. He took your act. I don't look like that, and I don't act. He did this, man, he sure ripped you off, and all that kind of shit. And I've never felt that way. But I knew something was that's part one. Part two of knowing that something was happening. The second part was not long after that, I'm on the road, and Robert Cray Band is, and we're playing in Santa Cruz. Mm-hmm. Now, we can't afford a hotel room, so we stayed on people's living room floors or couches. And it had been a rough night for me the night before because I partied all night, and I fell asleep in the van. So I'm totally in my suit, if you can imagine this, when there's a knock, knock, knock on the door. Knock, knock, knock. Curtis, get up. Knock, knock, knock. And it's Robert, and he says, John Belushi's on the phone. And it's about 8 in the morning. I go, what? He goes, yeah, Belushi's on the phone. How in the fuck do you find us here? So I go in, and I go, he goes, John, yeah, Curtis, how are you? I'm asleep. And he goes, what? I go, how'd you find us? And he goes, I have my way. I will never forget that. So again, he found somebody who figured out where we were. And to me, I'm not even, you know, I don't know. He knew somebody who knew where we were. So we start talking. He goes, yeah, so man, I'm doing a record. We did that show and now we're recording a record and we're going to, this is before he even recorded it. He goes, we're going to do this concert and we're going to record it live. And I just wanted to tell you. And he called me and goes, yeah, you know, what do you think of Steve Cropper? I think Steve Cropper is great. And he goes, what do you think of Donald Duck Dunn? Donald Duck, yeah, McIntyre Murphy. Yeah, McIntyre, what's going on? He goes, yeah, that's the band I have. He called me up. When I didn't really hit me at first, but he was calling me up, get my permission if I thought they were cool.
That's
really
funny.
And he knew they were cool. So, yeah, I mean, he knew they were cool and whatever. And, you know, this is when he said this. He goes, yeah, we were going to have Room Full of Blues, but they kind of made them mad. I go, I didn't know Duke Robillard in Room Full of, I would end up singing in Room Full, like, about 4 years later. But I go, what? Why is that? He goes, well, I shook up a beer at the Lone Star Tavern in New York, and I sprayed the audience, and the audience sprayed the band back. So he was on stage with Room Full of Blues, and he shook up a beer, sprayed the audience. The New York audience shook up their beers and sprayed the entire band
with
Blues. And Duke Robillard was not happy, and he kicked him off the stage.
Oh, wow.
And got on his guitar, got down the horns, and that was the end of Room Full of Blues. Would have been in the movie if they would have continued it. But they were trying other bands out as well. But that was one of the main ones. I think they were auditioning and looking for a band to be the Blues Brothers, and then they turned around and just bought the best band.
Yeah.
You know, Paul Schaefer probably helped them. I'm guessing all this. I do know Tom Malone, the trombone player, though, and other people. So I have pieced together somewhat what has happened right out of from the horse's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
On my story, you know, everybody has their own reality. But in my story, that is what happened. We played, and then Belushi called us up, and we were staying at some friends' houses. And I took the phone call, and Belushi says, yeah, we're going to make a record, and here's what's important. Belushi goes, I go, God, well, can we open up for you? And he goes, Curtis, I can't. I go, well, why not? He goes, well, we're opening up for Grateful Dead. We're doing this at Winterland. I go, but, you know, we could be, he goes, he just stopped me short. He goes, Curtis, they'll figure out where I got this. And that is the key thing I'll never forget.
Interesting.
They can't, you know, they'll figure out where I got this shit from. Which was kind of a nice thing to say.
I think
anyhow,
so, yeah.
Kind of strange, you know. I mean, yeah. I could take it either way. I'm not complaining. And then as time went on, you know, I have other stories to say. Like, you know, he gave me an opportunity. Like, what do you want from this? What is it can I do that can help you? And this is back when he was making Animal House. Mm-hmm. I was having dinner with him. He goes, what can I do to help you? What is it? And I should have said, well, I would like a kind of a creation, you know, or there's probably a word for it, for something like, because I turned him on all this stuff, and he
right.
kind of, you know, and later on, when I was hanging out with him in Hollywood, he said the same thing again. Because, you know, if you got a lawyer, you could get money for helping. But he didn't say how or when or where, and when he asked me at his house, it was like, you know, Curtis, you could get sort of the creational fee out of this, you know, like, hey, da-da-da-da-da, I'm the guy to help put this together, they could give me a percentage of the record, whatever. They dedicated the record to me, and they called Cab Calloway's character Curtis.
Right.
And, well, that's yours truly. I mean, I'm not guessing that. I was told that by Aykroyd and Belushi, mm-hmm. and they dedicated the record. So that's the Blues Brothers story. It goes on, you know. It goes on until about the, at one point, they arbitrarily got a recording of us live. And on that live tape from the Troubadour, the L.A. famous Troubadour venue in L.A., mm-hmm. off of Santa Monica, I believe, our sound man gave them a tape of us live of the Robert Craig Band. And on that was some material that was rare because nobody else was playing it on planet Earth. And some original stuff.
Hmm.
Belushi called me up and said, hey, we're going to do this song. And it was a very rare song it was Sonny Boy Williamson singing a song called From the Bottom. I had acquired this from a collector of old and rare records,
yeah.
who put it on a tape for me and said, you guys ought to do this. And From the Bottom is Sonny Boy Williamson, B.B. King, and probably Peck Curtis on drums. And, you know, it's just like the three of them, and they're doing this song, From the Bottom. And it's really cool. And the Robert Cray Band took it and evolved into it. Richard playing bass, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We did the song live, and now Belushi's got a hold of it. And out of all the songs that we were doing on that show, that's the one he picked out. So he called me up to say, what are the words of this song? What song? I don't know. It's Hollywood Bound? I said, you mean From the Bottom? Is that the name of it? Yes. Well, that's the song we're doing. Yeah, well, we're going to do it on our next record. Hey, man, I said, that's something we're going to do on our next record. Yeah, we'd like to do that song. It's kind of like, I'm the one who found it. It was given to me by blah, blah, blah. You know, he's going like, mm-hmm. well, you know, Matt Guitar Murphy's in our band. I don't care if Matt Guitar Murphy's in your band or not. And that's nobody else is doing that song. Anyhow, he stole that song.
Oh, wow. I never knew that.
Yeah, yeah. And nobody else is playing it. And, I mean, that's how, literally, if you go to the Blues Brothers, the arrangement they're playing is ours, the Robert Cray Band. Because there isn't any horns on it, and there isn't
right.
any bass on it, and I don't, you know, so we were doing this, and they pretty much, pretty closely lifted it. Now, you know, you can't beat Sonny Boy Williamson's version of it, and whatever, but we got in a big argument there, and, you know, it just kind of ended up fizzled out. The argument fizzled out. We went on, talked mm-hmm. some stuff. And later on, I went to go see the Blues Brothers live at the Concord Pavilion in California. And I'm sitting there, and next to me is sitting his wife, Judy Jacklin.
Mm-hmm.
When she reaches out and grabs my leg and squeezes it and says, don't leave and don't get angry. said, why? She goes, just chill, kind of. And all of a sudden, they launched into From the Bottom.
Oh, jeez.
And that tells you how nice Judy Jacklin is. Judy was aware of what I kind of was going through because I watched it all. I watched the snowball roll and get bigger and bigger and bigger. Meanwhile, I'm still playing in a little bar. So, yeah, you kind of get a little bit of a chip on your shoulder. But, then it went away. You know, it's just like, I'm proud to be part of that. I was a major part in being John Belushi's muse. Not Aykroyd, it was his idea, the whole Blues Brothers thing. You know Aykroyd lives in Toronto, and there's a band there called the Down Child Blues Band.
Right.
And in that band are brothers, two guys that are our brothers. That was Darren Aykroyd. He was into the blues long before Belushi, and he was into that band. So that's kind of where he kind of started. And they checked out other stuff. I'm not the only one, but for me, as far as Belushi's concerned, I was his muse. I was the one they dedicated the record to. I was, because we remained friends, and I fed him material and ideas, and so I'm proud of that. A lot of other people go, Blues Brothers suck, man. Hey, the Blues Brothers made a large... I think the Blues Brothers opened up the door for a lot of artists, and it opened up it turned on a lot of people to the blues, made them aware, and it kind of relaunched some of important people's careers. You know, didn't hurt Ray Charles, and it didn't hurt James Brown.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I'm one of. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean. I'm very proud of that. You know, I play a part. I'm not a meanie and a little me and this and that, but that's what happened to me. And here's the thing, kind of a full round circle is I still talk with Judy Jacklin, and we still get together, and I just had lunch with her 3 weeks ago.
Oh, really?
In Portland. Yeah. I talk about it at every interview, everything, so it's really not going to leave my life. I don't want it to. It's fine with me. The movie's fantastic, I think, and it did great things, and I have no animosity or like, gee, I should have been in it, or why didn't I? You know, had I been smart at the age of 23, I would have said, I'm like a little piece of the action here. All I want is for the music to be known, these people, I am on a mission from God, and I want people to know how cool the music is, and these artists, the Black Masters were, and the people who are playing it, you know, and the people who did play it, and the reason why, you know, how it came to be. I'm fascinated with that.
Yeah, I mean, so, I'm just going to say, right. I'm one of the people that, you know, the Blues Brothers, I first watched it when I was 6 or 7, and that kind of launched me into this... You know, okay, you know, I see what they're playing. I want to know where that came from. So that's
how
I got into the blues, and that's how I learned about you, and I, you know, learned to love your music as well. So I think it opened up a lot of people's, you know, eyes and ears to the blues music.
Hey, man, so we're on the same page. So I'm telling you your story. I'm telling my story is just the same as yours.
Absolutely, yeah.
When my older sister's like, wow, who are these people?
Yeah.
You know, I got a Paul Butterfield record and was like, who's M. Morganfield? And then you do some research, and you didn't have a computer back then. You find out it's McKinley Morganfield, the real name of Muddy Waters.
Right.
Or who's C. Burnett? You know, Chester Burnett. Who was Marion Walter Jacob, you know. Looks like you have the name of Marion. No wonder he got in a lot of fights. Anyhow, you know, and then once I heard that stuff, I was off. And then, of course, soul music and jazz. And it's all basically, you know, it's all basically I'm into black music, which has spread its roots everywhere, man.
It's like a
good fast food restaurant. It's like a good restaurant, man.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
You can't beat a good meal, and you can't beat, you know, good music. And I think jazz and blues and gospel and soul is the shit.
No argument there. So I know that you've kind of had your share of health problems. I know recently you had a quadruple bypass, and I was happy to hear that everything went well for you. Now, my grandpa, he's had about 5 heart attacks in his life, and he was in his 50s when he had his first. After that, he kind of retired and just kind of focused on himself, and with your incredible career, you easily could have just done the same thing. What made you want to just keep playing the blues?
Well, you know, if I can make this sure, is basically what I do is rhythm and blues.
Sure.
I mean, yeah. I'm glad you want to just shorten it to that, because, I love Bootsy, and I love Parliament, and I like Rage Against the Machine, and I like The Pretenders, and I could go on and on. Sam Cooke and gospel music, the Dixie. I like music that hits me, you know. And so, but what I do and what I know that I can do and put across is blues and soul. And that's R&B. That's what I am. So I just want to so what made me want to continue playing R&B is basically, it's all I know how to do. And I can't survive unless I do it. It's basically how I make a living. So people ask me that, like, oh, you could have retired, you know. But they don't put it like you did, and that's exactly what they mean. What made you go on, mm-hmm. you know? Well, yeah, I got to go on. This is what I do. It's all I know. I don't know anything else. You know, I know how to talk, as you can tell, and talk about music, and I know how to perform and sing. And this is all I know how to do. I don't know any technology stuff, and I don't want to. I can hang a picture and saw a few boards, but, you know, I don't really want to be working in construction.
Sure.
I don't know how to wire a house.
Yeah, no, I get that. So I want to talk about your latest album, Rough Cut. You did that with Alan Hager, and it has some really, really great tracks on it. In your opinion, what kind of makes this album different than your previous work?
Well, you know, it is just that. It's a pre-war album.
Mm-hmm.
It's an attempt at making pre-war blues. Some of the songs are, except for a few, most of them are pre-war songs or written in that style.
Yeah.
And so there's some original stuff. But the other one is Alan Hager himself. He's more of a musicologist. I think he's I think I know everything, but I can go to him in the encyclopedia of history. And as I am as well, I think his book is thicker than mine. And Alan has been playing pre-war style guitar since before, you know, since he was a teenager. And then he went on to, you know, classical music on the guitar. He loves finger picking. But his first love was, when he was 17 years old, he called up Sunhouse to wish him happy birthday. And he did this by going to the Portland Library, checking out a phone book of Rochester, New York, going through the Rochester, New York, phone book, finding Eddie House and the address that he had learned from the back of an album of they re-recorded mm-hmm. Sunhouse. And I think it was on Columbia or something like that.
But, I think so.
Al Wilson of Canned Heat had something to do with it.
Right.
On the back of it, they gave his address. And Alan went to the library, looked it up in the phone book, and called him up to wish him happy birthday. So that's the kind of guy. And we've been making music together since 2003. And that's when a guy named Terry Robb, I've heard of not only from Terry Robb, but other people got to see this guy. But every time I went to see Alan, he was always just the rhythm guitar player. And I didn't hear him do his acoustic or single solo thing. And one day I did in 2003. And I said, you want to work with me? We could get some money and work on off nights. And maybe we can. We did score a gig at a place called the Cascade Bar and Grill in Vancouver, Washington. And I know that's not important, but that's where it was. And we started working there. And we worked there, probably for 2 years and started playing all over the place other than there. And we'd never rehearsed. We just got together and said, do you know this song? Yeah, well, let's do it. And he sounds like two people. He makes enough noise on that guitar to, like, fill it up, and then me on harmonica. And what you're hearing on that record, that's what it is. There's no overdubbing.
Wow.
You know. I do overdub a little bit of harmonica on the song. I don't. Maybe it's not on that record. I do overdub some harmonica, but that's it. It's basically him and me. And so I tried to write songs that were... We tried to write songs that were pre-war, kind of, you know, or, mm-hmm. yes, pre-war, to fit along with our, you know, other songs, like Long Train Blues, Sun Houses, other one, Depot Blues. We do Can't Be Satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
It's 1948, Muddy Waters, so that's after the war. No, that's... Yeah, it's after the war. What else did we do on there? Al Wilkinson song. And then we wrote songs that were pre-war style. So, I mean, it's totally different than my R&B bag. So,
yeah.
You know, I could have shortened that whole question up and just went, one's R&B and one's pre-war. That's it, you know. All my other records are rhythm and blues songs, or rhythm and blues records. And, basically, it's all my contemporary stuff is soul and blues and rock and roll
mm-hmm.
and gospel kind of feel. Everything that's underneath the rhythm and blues umbrella. And it's what I like to say. Under that roof.
Sure.
And that pretty much means, yeah, blues, jazz, soul, rock and roll, gospel. And I don't... So I just wanted really to show off Alan Hager. But this is something, I thought we had something special, and I think he's special. And so I wanted to make a record, and we both talked about it. Like the kind we like to listen to. A lot of duos these days and stuff like that, they all want that really raw stuff, you know, really, let's, you know. And to me, man, I like Leo Kottke records, and I like, you know, Mississippi John Hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Those ones that are really, you know, really fine guitar playing, and there's a lot of that stuff. And I like raw as well, you know. And that's why I made it, because I thought we had something hot, and I think Alan Hager is brilliant.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with you. You guys together, I mean, yeah. It's a really, really great sound. Absolutely.
My next record coming out is with three different rhythm sections from three different locations. One is Nashville. One is Greaseland in San Jose, and one is down in Los Angeles at with the Phantom Band and some of those guys. And three different rhythm sections, and I'm doing all original blues, a lot of rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm doing rockabilly, I'm doing New Orleans style. Rock and roll. I'm doing a few soul songs and some blues songs. And so that's kind of the same old what I do, but this is totally, totally different for me. And this isn't all originals. My last one, The Beautiful Lowdown, had one cover song on it. This one has no cover songs.
Wow.
And so that's what I'm doing. I'm very excited about it.
I'm looking forward to hearing it.
I hope so. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. Curtis, thank you again so much for talking with me.
Yeah, and sorry about that, whatever.
Ah, you're fine.
There's a bunch of great artists out there that I can't remember their names.
That's all right.
Yeah. So anyhow, Sam, thank you so much.
Certainly.
For the push, and honored. Come up and say hello.
I will.
You have my phone number. Use it if you wish to shoot the shit about music.
I appreciate it. I'll take you up on it.
All right, man.
Thanks, Curtis. Have a good one.
Take care, man. Yeah, have a nice day.